Folks, welcome back to the iHealth channel, iHealth Radio, where your host, Hurricane Age, new day, new show, awesome topic, a topic as, you know, I always say is topic of need. We cannot have enough of it. It is topic that's going to touch with an expert on our mental health and talking maybe about, you know, traumas and how we can work around them. And I'll talk also about some maybe practical guides to love and compassion, maybe inner peace. I mean, there's a lot of stuff we're going to be able to talk about today with our doctor. I mean, they are a couple, but we only have one of the units of the couple today. But I'm going to announce them. So we are supposed to have Dr. Dean Sanseri and Holly Kemp Sanseri, but we only have with us today Dr. Dean. Fortunately, Dr. Holly Kemp is not available, but you know, hopefully we'll catch her next time. But they are a partner, they are a unit, and they work and help people really get better in their mental health and relationships and so on and so forth. And today we're gonna just tackle those elements, because these are elements of life that we need. Dr. Sanseri, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's so good to be here. You know, my wife is she was going to be here, but her girlfriends invited her to the beach in Destin. And she begged me to say, can I go? I need this for my mental health. So anyway, of course, honey. So she'll be here next time. But she's on the beach sunning right now. It's a place we all want to be, huh?
Well, yeah. Well, it's funny that you said that. I mean, when she throws in the mental health, you know, what are you going to do?
You're not going to what am I going to do?
You're helping people, right?
Well, it's also a tribute to her. She's going with her girlfriends that have been her friends since she was a teenager, and she's 64 years old. So it says something about the longevity of relationships and the beauty of that. So, yeah, of course, honey, go. Have a great time.
Well, you know, doctor, I could just make a show just about what you just mentioned right now. I mean, there's plenty there. The relationships, you know, with friendship. And how it works, because I mean, there was a problem today. I mean, to really have someone of that long, you know, lifespan, you know, as a sidekick, partner, friend, it's very difficult. We don't see much of that anymore, and we can touch on that as if you don't mind, doctor. And then the idea, as you said, like, you know, sometimes you want to decompress, right? You want to do something. I mean, life is too tight. Too much stuff going on, and something like this does help. So maybe, you know, we can touch on those, you know, as a start point. But before we do that, you know, let's just tell us a little bit about you guys and the work you do. Really, I mean, I do an introduction, but it's never enough. If you can tell us a little bit about your background and the work you've done and where and all that, and then we can dive into the real McCoy here.
Yeah, well, we're both we've been married 33 years. We met in New Orleans. I actually was coming out of the seminary when I met her. And she was coming out of the streets. She's a recovering drug addict, been sober, you know, many, many years, I guess close to 40 years almost. But so we met and we were coming from very different places, but we were on the same journey. We both had experienced a certain levels of brokenness connected to the impact of addiction on our lives. And we're on a pretty intensive journey to recover who we really are and who we're meant to be. And so we were both about 3 or 4 years down our journey when we did meet, and then we ended up getting married. And that's been our life's work, is really a lot of the things that we've learned along the way in terms of going from a life that was life-taking to a life that's life-giving. You know, and I think that's probably the transition we're all seeking to do, is go from a life taker to a life giver, huh?
Beautiful. Well, you know, doctor, it's amazing that you're sharing the background that's way back in time, and really, you know, how you said, you know, you're coming from different parts of the world, but for the same purpose or journey ahead of you, and you kind of connected, you partnered up, and the rest is history. And you've been, you know, not only working, you worked for yourselves, and you know, to improve yourselves and your life, personal life, and then you kind of took that to the others, to the world, because I always find that fascinating. And, you know, I've stated this many times in similar shows where I love when people go through something and they find it a way and a mission in their life to actually transform people, because they don't want others to go through exactly what they've been through. And that's actually, you know, even in the work you do, I think that's very important, because people sometimes will not relate to you if you have no clue. I mean, you come from school. Hey, I'm an expert. Well, you know, what do you know, right? You haven't gone through it. But when you tell them like, hey, this is our journey here. We've been in the trenches. We know what we've been in your shoes. It makes a whole different, you know, statement when you actually try to help people. So that's all amazing. Go ahead, Doug.
Yeah. And I agree with that 100%. I really believe and tell people, I said, oftentimes your purpose is in your pain. And that when we experience difficult things, you know, we either start a healing process from that, or we internalize it and act it out in lots of different ways. And so there's a crossroad that we come to that happens. And so I always say, look, sometimes the most shameful things that you've experienced, if you're able to get on a healing continuum, that's going to end up becoming your treasure, that you'll be able to serve others. And so, for example, for both of us, we were impacted by addiction. You know, I was a teenager when my father's drinking began to escalate more. And in early 20s, he ended up, through a series of pretty powerful events, went to treatment and was there for 30 days. Back in those days, you'd go for 28 days. And the third week of treatment, the whole entire family went to the treatment center and learned about alcoholism, drug addiction, the impact on family systems. And I went, and that was a real eye opener for me, because not only did I see, you know, my dad struggle, but I could see my own early struggles, right? And so I really embraced that whole healing process. Thank God my dad did also. He's been sober ever since then. He's 86, 87 years old now, and has been sober ever since that time. And our relationship has turned. But also, all of a sudden, this thing that was the most shameful thing in my life, dealing with the drinking, dealing with the impact on my parents' marriage, my family falling apart, the impact on me, how I was responding to that, all of a sudden was transformed into something that has been how I've given life to so many people. And not that it has to be exactly like that, but I think all of us can find treasures in our history if we're willing to work with them and not run from them. And the same with Holly Kim. I mean, she was on the streets, you know, doing cocaine and out of control. And then 21, 22 years old, got arrested, ended up getting sober and clean. And I can't tell you hundreds and hundreds of, if not thousands of people she's helped over the years break off those self-destructive behaviors. And so we both could see like the hand of God, in a sense, guiding us to say, okay, we're going to turn this most difficult thing into something that's going to be life-giving. I think that's part of all of us can experience somewhat the same things if we're able to really not be ashamed of our histories, but to embrace them.
Well, thank you, Doc. Well, we're going to talk about how we can get out of those things, and certainly, but I want to touch on the like some of the sources and the events that actually push people and put them into that predicament in the first place. I mean, you mentioned your dad, for example, drinking, and by the way, drinking is very common across, and I don't think it has any barriers or borders, because I think everyone around the world somehow there is alcoholism and drug addiction, so it's a big deal, right? Worldwide, even though in some countries they claim that there's no drugs and stuff, they still have them. The problem is not really hidden, you know, in the world. It's big, and the impact of it is really more. and the idea is that there are things that push people to do this in your work. I mean, certainly you talked about, you know, your wife being in the, you know, doing the coke and all the stuff in those days. But there's something that probably triggered that. I mean, you didn't have that, but you had in your family, right? You with your dad. So what in your work, you know, what are some of the common, I guess, contributors to people really get into this? Is it trauma? Is it, you know, I mean, people don't like to self-destruct themselves just like that. Is it bad influence? It's the events they go through. I mean, that's a big one. I mean, because I think that's the root cause of where the problem is, besides the idea that it's also handy and available to all of us. Because, I mean, you can get this stuff anywhere.
Yeah. Well, it really relates to what we articulate in our book, A Roadmap to the Soul. But what we teach is that we all experience emotional pain in life. We all, just because of our human condition, we lose people that we love, we lose relationships, we lose jobs, we have financial difficulties. All those things are natural in life. And when we experience those events, the natural response to that is emotional pain. If my best friend moves to another city, it's natural for me to feel sad and hurt and angry and lonely. And if I embrace and give voice to those emotions, I start to release them and I start moving into a healing process. If I internalize those emotions on the inside, it's like putting a rock in a sack. And another event happens and I put another rock in a sack. And I put it, and pretty soon I have a big sack of rocks I'm carrying around. How do I deal with those sack of rocks? I need to find a way to mood alter in order to disconnect me from that sack of rocks. So in one sense, we all develop coping behaviors to deal with that. And those coping behaviors work for us originally, but over time they work against us. So in our language, we say that sack of rocks is called the wounded child. It doesn't mean I was wounded in childhood. It's just a word to describe the emotional pain I carry on my inside. And over time, I develop my coping behavior, which we call a protector. And that coping behavior, like I said, works for me, but begins to work against me. So for example, if the way I, when I was in pain or upset when I was a teenager, I'd go for long walks on the levee, clear my head, I was fine. So if I was in pain, I would isolate and not talk. It worked beautiful. But I get married to my wife and we get in a little argument and a part of me says, go talk to her. But another part says, go for a long walk and come back and don't talk about it. And something else happens. Go for a long walk and come back and don't talk about it. I do that 5 or 6 times and all of a sudden all these problems are piling up in my relationship. And this very behavior that worked for me is now working against me. Now, when our behavior that we choose to help us cope is a substance or an addictive behavior, then it begins to take a life of its own over time. I mean, I'm not against drinking. Everybody have a little drink. But when it becomes the way I cope with life and I get attached to it, then it takes a life of its own. So, for example, one time I worked with a guy who was using cocaine and he said, I heard you can help me quit using. Can you help me? I said, well, when's the last time you used? He said, last Wednesday. I said, never again. I'm spending my money. I'm fighting with my girlfriend. It's affecting work a little bit. I got to quit. He said, the following Friday, I went to my buddy's house. My girlfriend was working. When I walked in, there was some cocaine on the table. He said, a voice in my head said, get out right now. You're going to use. He said, the other voice said, nah, just go hang out with the guys. No, get out right now. You're going to use. Just go hang out with the guys. So he went to hang out with the guys. A little while later, get out right now, you're going to use. He said, the other voice said, look, use today and quit tomorrow. Be a brand new day. He ended up using. He gets home. He gets in his fight with a girlfriend because she can see he's using. And he woke up the next morning with sincere remorse and guilt because he really made a commitment to quit. And to me, he was describing so beautifully the dialogue between the true self of who I really am and his coping behavior. And so addiction is when that coping behavior takes a life of its own and it has more power than who I really am. So if I have 100% power and my true self, who I am, has 80% power, my coping behavior has 20, then it just whispers, go do this. Let's use. No. I'm good. I know where that goes. But if I have 20% power, my coping behavior has 80, then over. It's running the show, and I'm in the backseat like, what are you doing? This is crazy. You're spending your money. You're lying. But our coping behaviors and our wounds are directly proportionate. If I'm carrying 100 pounds of emotional pain on the inside, my coping behavior is going to be 100 pounds strong. If events occur and my coping behavior my wounds become 1,000 pounds, then my coping behavior becomes 1,000 pounds strong. And it starts to take up a life of its own. And that's when I begin to lose myself. So when we say, how does this happen? Well, it's an issue of emotional management. Because I'm either going to learn to manage my emotions in a healthy way from what I call my true self, or my coping behavior will. And when it does, it starts to take a life of its own and it destroys everything that's important to me. So part of what we do is we help people separate those three parts of themselves. And not only put the cork in the bottle if I'm drinking too much, but teach you how to manage the emotional pain so that we can quiet this other voice. And that's sort of the process in a nutshell of a roadmap to the soul of how to break free from self-destructive behaviors.
You know, I have to say, it's a beautiful description of the real thing. I mean, because I think every one of us could relate to that one. I mean, we all Absolutely. Have those two voices. We all have that, you know, hey, you got this. The other one's like, no, just it's be cool, man. It's just a one touch, it's one time. It's okay. Have fun. And to your point is, how do we, you know, control which side, and whether we have control on the better behavior on self, if that's the other one. But that takes a lot of will and really understanding yourself and strength. The problem, I think, when we have emotional baggage, you know, and pain, you know, we lose that strength. You know, I think that's really where the difficulty is, because not everybody is strong enough to fight the fight on their own. And you said, it depends on what's that emotional pain level and where it's coming from. It could be too close to comfort. I mean, you're talking about a relationship, for example, husband, wife, spouse, right? Parents, kids. It becomes too strong, and sometimes, you know, you just can't handle it, and therefore you kind of find that the coping, you know, system, right?
Right, and the coping system, sure.
And those copings are not usually good for you. And sometimes they're enabled by your surroundings and stuff, because we put ourselves into that environment. So exactly. so now let's talk about that. Like, you know, no power, right? I mean, when someone works with you, obviously you help them there, but a lot of people don't have you. I mean, they have access to you. The problem is they don't know how to do it. A lot of people are refusing to get the help. I mean, when you talked about the example of your dad, for example, he went to the actual treatment. Some people may not see the treatment as an option because they don't think they need the treatment. They're in denial.
Yeah, right. And, you know, it's interesting about that, because I've done interventions over the years. I've probably done over 100, you know, over the years, in intervening on someone that's suffering with a self-destructive behavior and some type of addiction or some. And part of what works, because the success rate that I've had is well in the 90 percentile in terms of them going to treatment. And it's because what I've learned is that you're not going to talk someone into getting help intellectually. That they need to, the only thing that works is love. And the only thing that works is to be direct and honest and loving from the people closest to that person. So, you know, if I have a friend who flips a car because they're drunk and almost dies, and I say, you know, don't you know it's stupid not to drink and drive, and that you put yourself at risk and other people at risk? It's like, yeah, I know that. I mean, sure, that's not going to have an impact. But if I say, listen, you know how much you mean to me. You're my friend. We go way back. I love you, man. And when you flipped that car, the thought, I was so afraid that I might lose you. And the thought of losing you was just devastating to me. Man, I wish you would consider maybe getting some help, man. Now, the second one's going to get a lot more leverage than the first one, right? Because I'm speaking to you directly, honestly, from my heart. And an intervention is when you get all the people closest to the person who love them to do the same thing. And so I'll have them write letters, and I say, Joe, I'm here because I love you. And when this happened, I felt sad. When this happened, I felt scared. When this happened, Joe, I love you, and I want you to get some help. Now, when you have enough people doing that and you bathe in them with care, you're not beating up on them. You're not even judging them. You're just saying, look, when I heard you got fired the third time and it had to do with your drug use, you know, I felt real concerned for you. Right? It's your actions and how it impacted my heart, and I'm being honest about that. That's the most loving thing. And I always say to the people, well, what if they get upset with me? What if they get mad? I said, you need to love them enough to risk the relationship. And that's what gets through. So yes, everybody's in some level of denial. When my father went to treatment, he needed to go to treatment for years. But we did an intervention. We had people that were significant that read the letters, and he broke down and he said, yeah, I know, I need to get some help. And we had his bags packed and we took him right to treatment. But there were many times that we talked. It's like, Dad, this is not going right. You know, or we were scared to talk or this and that. Or being berated or whatever. No. It was when he was surrounded by love, it woke him up. Wow. And then that's when he got his help. And then the treatment team did the job of keeping him awake.
You know, doctor, I'm listening to you. And it's funny because it's got to sound cliche here, but it's not what you say is how you say it. I mean, it's really that formula of that message that makes a difference to impact someone's, you know, I guess, decision making. And you really touch on it, I mean, beautifully. I mean, like we also say, like, you get more with honey than you get with vinegar, right? If you go that the rough way, it's not going to make a difference. You're just going to be like creating more reaction and more like, you know, no and resistance. But when you show that you really care generally, you know, you want to help and that they mean to you, they because it's not them anymore. They think about the impact that they have on others, and that can change, you know, the way. So they're more accepting of what the next steps are. And I love what you said. Good example. Your dad, you know, yeah, you could talk all you want, but the day that he realized that, hey, we all are, you know, caring, we want to see you do better, it changed. But you know, that's a beautiful thing as far as family members, people who have family, people who have people that care about them. But there are people out there that may not have those loved ones, if you want to call it that way, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's not unfortunately, we live in the world and not everybody's got equal family values or equal, you know, surroundings, right? And so sometimes some people may, and we find that in some areas where people may not have, you know, they've brought up with, you know, orphans, for example, or they may not have the right parenthood, right? Or the parents separated early or whatever, and they find themselves alone. So that road is a lot more dangerous because they're solo. I mean, they're just really in the fight for themselves. And the energies out there are just more available. And there's quite a bit of out there. I mean, it's almost by design. You have drugs and you have, you know, all these temptations and places where you can really easily get that. And these are destructive things, but people sometimes don't have someone to help them. How do we touch with those people? How, you know, what's available to them? I mean, obviously they can, you know, they probably can hear a show, they can do this, there's TV, this stuff, but they don't have that personal touch of individuals in their love, you know, circle, life and love circle, right? So how do we, what's your take on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there are a lot of resources available in terms of this free support group meetings, and that's where you can get education and love. Certainly the 12-step programs are very powerful and they're free. Other resources, you know, I mean, certainly a person has to be willing, and, you know, hopefully that happens. I had an interesting thing occur that a friend of mine is a pastor in Juarez, Mexico. His name's Pastor Pancho Merguille, wonderful guy. He is an extraordinary man. And at the height of Juarez cartel battles, there was 5,000 murders, I think, in 3 years. I mean, it was just unbelievable. He said, I need to do something. We need to do something about the murder problem and the violence in our city. So he actually set up a tent in the park and went on a 30 day fast and was praying for solutions. And the newspaper would come to him every morning and say, well, basically, what is God telling you about our city? And he would say, he was read scripture all day. And it was just kind of a bizarre thing that he did. But he started implementing some of these strategies that he got. And in 19 months, the murder rate went down 70%. And it was extraordinary. But I was asking him, like, What is it that you did that helped this? And he gave credit to God and the strategies he got. But he said, one thing I learned, Dean, was that you can't change anything that you don't love. I said, what? He said, you can't change anything that you don't love. I said, so he said, we had sicarios all around our city killing people. And he said, we all hated the sicarios and we condemned them and we judged them and rightfully so. I mean, they were creating havoc. He said, but I went before my church community and he said, we need to learn to love these sicarios, not love what they're doing, but love them.
The humans, yeah.
And we're going to start adopting them and praying for them. And that's what he did. And he said he started having sicarios show up at his church. And they were led there. And some of them, while they were in prison, had these encounters with the Lord. And all these bizarre things started happening. And he said that was when things started shifting. These things started happening that they didn't even, it was through prayer. But it was through prayer that was connected to a heart of love. So when I heard that hurricane, I said, that applies to ourselves. We can't change anything about ourselves that we can't learn to love. Not necessarily agree with. I mean, if I speak disrespectfully to my wife, you know, that's not okay. But I need to understand and learn to love that part of me and why and what's causing that and give it attention in order for it to change. Because if I don't, it's not going to change. So therein is the crux of the matter is that I need to learn to love the part of me that's carries my pain about life events, if experience trauma. I need to learn to love my coping behaviors, my self-destructive coping behaviors. And in the process of doing that, they actually begin to change. And I become more of who I'm destined to become. I begin to take the power away from those other parts of me.
Awful stuff. Yeah. And by the way, I think, Doctor, you touched on something that is huge because a good example, and it's not something I actually, throughout my work, I used to work with community affairs in New York, right? And I'm not a cop, but because we did a lot of community work and outreach with the community affairs department, you know, we were really close with them. And one of the things that they had said, gangs, for example, right? You know, a lot of the gang members, they do that because they want a family. They want that love, and they find that love in that environment. And what you stated here is that you're right. When we reject people, they'll find a place where they can thrive. But if you bring them on board and you love them, there's a very good chance that you can convert them and change their behavior and their mind. And so because they found what they're looking for, they don't have to seek in those environments any help. They become better and say, change the stuff. And you're right. So if we actually accept people and maybe, bring them closer than actually rejecting them, there's a good chance they'll change and they'll see that whatever they do. Because at the end of the day, it's something that we've discussed in a previous show and with Dr. Haim, our outstanding doctor, is that, even these guys, when you think about them, they're dealing with their own traumas and their own problems and stuff like that. And that's what drives them. They don't even realize sometimes what they do because they're just deep in and they haven't taken one chance to do it, whether through fear or other things, but that's what they know. So it changes, how people behave when we kind of just shut the door and say, we don't have anything to do with you. It is everybody's problem, sometimes. I mean, when you see bad things happening and you don't intervene, I mean, certainly that you're part of the problem.
Yeah.
I think a lot of us can relate to this because, sometimes we just like, it's not my problem. But it is everybody. If you live in a community and there's some sort of a problem and you just don't do anything about it, that means you're part of the problem. You're not resolving it. You're not addressing it. It's pretty deep stuff, man. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I do agree. It is about responsibility. I mean, we're so disconnected and isolated in our community that we don't often take responsibility for anything beyond our little sphere. You know, I happen to live in New Orleans, and I love our city, and I love the people here. And I always tell my wife, I said, you know, when there's a murder that occurs in across town in a neighborhood that's not like ours, it still happened to us. And it's our responsibility to care for, because it's like a family, and anybody that's in the cities is family to me. And I try to approach it like that. I don't do it always real well, but that it's not them, it's us. And I think that that's key in what you're saying, is that there needs to be a shift in the way we think, that it's not us and them, but it's just an us. And that when someone's suffering across town, I'm suffering because they're part of my family. And we've lost touch with that, and we've kind of got it too so divisive, whether it's a political party or whether it's ethnic or whether it's social standing or whatever. But no, it's not. We're all human beings, and we're all part of a community, and our community needs to be family.
Well, that's, again, that's another deep point. I mean, and you mentioned you're in New Orleans. I mean, you mentioned earlier, you know, we'll have a joke about Hurricane and Katrina.
Yeah.
and you know, but you've seen it, you know, firsthand when a disaster hits, right? You know, people finally starts getting together in one unit and become, they look over all the differences, and they start looking at, you know, being just one big unit, one big team.
Yeah.
And sadly, we become that when it's very extreme. And hopefully, you know, maybe.
Yeah, there's two things that do that. There's tragedy, and there's sports teams, right?
Well, sports team could divide too. I mean, you know, people tend to, we have a lot of experiences in the world where people clash, you know, with fans, but you're right. You know, people get together. I don't care if I don't like you for who you are, but as long as we're in a game,
no,
and we support,
look,
the same team.
When,
yeah.
When the,
right, good.
When the Saints won the Super Bowl, I saw people hugging each other that would never hug each other.
Well, that's true. Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, you know, you listen, even you go to the bar, you go to a restaurant, you go whatever, everybody becomes so friendly and hugging and supporting, because now it's one common goal. That's the thing. It's really because now we're not looking at our differences. We're looking at, you know, one common achievement, target, and something that we all love and share together. And I think, as you said, keyword, we're humans. We share humanity. We should all care. I mean, a lot of tragedy around us. A lot of stuff happens around the world. And you said we have a lot of divide in, you know, in between for small things. And sometimes when you think about, like, what's the point? I mean, really, at the end of the day, we all live, we all die. And how do we contribute to this? I mean, are we contributing to society well, or we are just another player that is just allowing things to happen the wrong way and you not have any impact? So here's the good news. Doctor, you and your wife are making a difference. You are doing, you know, the work, and it started with you guys. But then, as I said, I love that model of you taking it on the road and helping thousands and thousands of lives. And I you know, and that's a question I have for you. I mean, are you in touch with some of the people that you've helped and where they are? Can you share some examples of people that were completely off and now they're thriving?
Yeah, well, there's many people that we've stayed in touch with over the years. You know, given the fact that we've been doing this over three decades, I mean, we've seen generations that have been impacted, from the parents to the children and now grandchildren. So it's been pretty interesting. But yeah, there's many people that we've seen grow. And you know, we're real big on marriages, in the sense that I do a lot of work with marriages, because I think that that's a fundamental unit that is the formation of the community. Now, I'm not against being single. That's too a very powerful lifestyle. But I do think the nuclear family is so foundational. And when that is strong, it has such a great impact. And when it's broken, it has such a great negative impact. And so there's a lot of concentration that, you know, if I can help save a marriage, then I save a family and I save a lot of different things. Not that I do it, but if I help facilitate that. And the opposite is true, too, is if a marriage is on the rocks and it ends up causing a divorce, it's just so devastating. There's financial losses, there's relationship losses, there's community losses, there's sometimes job losses, there's friend losses, there's the rippling effects are just so devastating. So I always tell couples, I say, look, you need to fight for this. You need to fight. You need to fight hard. There was something that brought y'all together in the original spark. We need to uncover that. But we also need to reconcile. And so there's a whole process that we use to help reconcile marriages. And that if we can do that, then you know, good things happen. You know, oftentimes when a person struggles in a marriage, I always say sometimes they're divorcing the wrong person. In a sense that we all carry our own issues into a marriage. And those issues were not created by our spouse. They were created from our histories. And oftentimes those issues or the wounded child part of what we call our emotional pain that we've been internalized, it's hidden at the beginning. You don't get to see it. But I get 6 months, year, and 2 years. I open up the suitcase and I say, okay, Hurricane, look what I brought. And you do the same. And we say, okay, what do we do with this now? And I really believe that we're meant to be partners in healing. Like whatever I brought into my marriage that I was still carrying, my wife was given to me to help me heal those places. And the same with her. But if we don't have the skills to do that, then we play these wounds out on each other. And that's what I'm very passionate about teaching individuals. Like, no. Let's teach you the skills to learn how to transform your wounds into healing so that you can become a more loving person, which is our journey. And not play these very wounds out on each other. So if I had a client who had a real controlling mom and was controlled on what to wear, how to wear, when to wear it, and so forth, and then the wife one day has impeccable taste and says, honey, I think you should wear that nice white button down, and the husband goes off on her. Why are you trying to control everything I wear? You're so controlling. All you women are the same. Blah, 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 and just lays into her. Like, who's he talking to? She's giving him good advice. But he's talking to
mom.
Memory of his mom. Mm. And look, we need to deal with that so that you can take this good advice from your mom so that you'll look good when you go out. And that's what happens in relationships is we get triggered. And we play out these wounds on each other, and then it just causes a spiral. I say, okay, look, we need to help you take responsibility for your wounds, your coping behaviors, your spouse to do the same, and we're going to teach you how to become partners in healing so that these very places can be let go. And when you can do that, it's just some skills and principles that we do that help facilitate that. And, you know, I could talk about some of the principles, but two of the most fundamental principles in any reconciliation in a marriage is two that actually spiritual principles that have psychological ramifications. There are two principles Jesus taught. One of them was repentance, and repentance is often seen as, you know, expressing sorrow towards God. But I'm talking about repentance towards a person. It means to have a heartfelt sorrow for the things that I have done that have hurt you. And taking full responsibility for those, verbalizing it, and making a commitment to do it differently. So if I isolate and don't talk, it's to say, honey, when we've gotten in arguments, I've isolated, not talked, it's hurt our relationship. It's hurt you. I'm sorry. And I'm making a commitment to learn to do it differently. And if both people can commit to true repentance of identifying their own behavior, even if it's in response to theirs, then we'll get somewhere. And the other principle is forgiveness. And forgiveness doesn't mean that I allow people to run over me. No, it means I recognize that you've done things that have hurt me in my heart. And I'm going to lay down that hurt on the altar and ask it to be removed. Now, those two principles actually usher in life into a relationship. Well, if we talk about them spiritually, Jesus said, repent for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. What he was basically saying is that heaven is around us, and how you activate it is by practicing these two principles of repentance and forgiveness. He said, but the opposite is true too. If you want hell in your relationship, never take responsibility and never forgive. And I promise you, you'll have lots of hell in your relationship. So those go together. And if I can get a couple to practice those two very simple principles, we can reconcile and get this ball rolling in a positive way and get this thing back on track.
You know, Doctor, I'm listening to you, and there's a couple of things. One is, certainly, those are they're very things that we can all do. I mean, repenting is really, as you said, just, you know, admitting and, you know, say, you know what, I was wrong. It's cool, right? You know, I can turn and leave. And forgiving is like when you allow people, like, okay, you made a mistake, no big deal, let's move on. But unfortunately, there's something called ego that actually is more powerful. It's like that whispering voice, right? It's like, well, you know, as you said, like, you know, I don't see the fault. There's no accountability. And the example you said about me, for example, talking to my wife, and the example of you, you know, screaming at your wife because of, you know, she is too demanding of some behavior that you actually relate to your mom. That's actually, you know, an interesting concept. You know, I love what you said, like, you know, we divorced the wrong person. I think, to your point, we got to divorce those feelings and memories.
Right. And, exactly.
And I mean, you know, it sounds easier now that I hear it. I mean, like, but nobody thinks about that. Like, you know, hey, I'm not divorcing my partner. I got to divorce all those bad, you know, I guess, anchors that I have in my mind. I mean, all the bad luggage that I carried for these years. And that's the thing, like, you know, we don't know sometimes about those until they trigger. Like, someone, like the example, would have been living with the mom. That's the concept. Then nothing. And then all of a sudden, someone that portrays exactly the same behavior, and it's like they lash out on them, yet that's not them. That they mean it in a good way now. But because they have the reaction, that's like basically just their, you know, fight, you know, in flight mode going on here.
Exactly.
Flight mode. It's amazing. I mean, but as you break it down, it makes, you know, like, we can do this, folks. I mean, really. And these are not very difficult concepts or foreign concepts to any of us watching. And by the way, I know you talk in the context of Christianity, but really all beliefs can have the same concept, because we all have the same concepts around the world.
Absolutely. And there's interesting. There's two characteristics of our wounds, emotional wounds that we carry. One is that they have no sense of time. So our wounds don't know the difference between 5 years old, 10 years old, 20, 30, 40 years old. It transcends time. And that part of us thinks in symbols. So there's certain symbols that can trigger the wounds. If I had, like that client I said, had a controlling mom, then the symbol could be just a controlling woman. If I had teachers that didn't treat me right, then I can, anybody that's an authority in my life that's in a higher position than me could be a trigger. You know, this anniversary dates can be a trigger. So there's lots of triggers that can happen, but if I'm ignorant of my triggers, then I'm going to think it's you. I mean, if you look like the kid down the street that beat the hell out of me and I was scared and bullied me, and I'm not aware of that trigger, and I look at you and I'm ready to fight you, like, you're a nice guy. Why am I ready to fight you? But you're going to get it if I'm not aware of the trigger. if I'm aware of the trigger, then I can say, look, Hurricane, you look like the kid down the street that used to beat the heck out of me. And, you know, like I got a lot going on the inside, but I really know it's not about you, but I'm just letting you know. Then we can deal with that. And so...
You know, Doctor, it's amazing you said that because it is very common. We see fights sometimes, right? That come out on the street, whatever. And people get like road rage, and really someone is just having a bad day because, as you said, something is happening in their life. Whether it's old, something just got them, you know, evoked in that same minute, whatever. But then you just happen to be in front of them, and then the energy is kind of like, you know, not jive, and then boom, and they lash out. It's amazing if we all take a minute just to breathe, like, hey, what's going on? I mean, I think we all overreact no matter what. I mean, as humans, we have weaknesses. Yeah. But if we start just to be aware of environments, you know, of signals, as you said, by the way, it goes both ways, right? It's a two-way
exactly.
street. You know, this is any one of us can have some luggage because we all experienced bad and good in our lives, some more than others. But at the end of the day, we have some luggage at a level, to your point, how big, what percentage, and how we can tame it or not tame it. But at the end of the day, we all have that little moment where we lose that moment, like, you know, we just kind of, what's going on here? Like, and then you like think about it for a minute, like, what the hell just happened? You know, that's not me. And we know that. I mean, I guarantee exactly. you, most of people know that when they're doing something, they just basically are almost like being possessed, you know, they're not them, but something's pushing them.
Exactly. Yeah. And I say it's, you know, we call it the voices within, in the sense that we have one voice, which is our pain voice, a wounded child. One voice is our coping behavior, and one is our true self. And there's always an inner dialogue going on. I need to know who's talking. You know, so if my wife looks aggravated, the wounded child part might say, you must have did something that upset her again, and you're never going to get it right. Protector might say, tell her to take the smirk off her face and get it straight. And then true self might say, honey, what's going on? It looks like you're bothered. Now, depending on who gets my voice, I'm going to get three different responses. I might hear all three of those in my head, but hopefully the third voice gets my voice and not the other two. And so we all have that in all kinds of situations. You know, if I'm going into a business sales situation, a part of me might be scared of being rejected. A part of me might be not want to go. And a part of me is excited about this opportunity. Well, that's pretty normal. If I know how to differentiate and manage the other two, then I can go into the sales meeting with confidence and deliver the pitch or whatever. So we all have this going on. We just simplify the process to say, we're going to categorize these and help you manage them so that you can do the things that you're called to do as an adult man and as an adult woman in this situation. And that's the process of managing these two. I don't think they ever go away. The intensity of them decrease, but we just need to learn to manage them.
So doctor, just a quick note. I mean, managing is one thing, having the support is one, but now when someone goes, for example, to these programs, right? And now there's drugs that are administered, right? And, you know, I mean, the drugs do kind of subdue your personal, you know, your I guess your chemicals, right? But it's not taking away the voices and stuff. So once the drugs are, you, let's say you remove yourself from this facility and you're done and you could, and you kind of rejected, let's say the poisons that were in your body that kind of got you, whatever the drugs that you take in or alcohol, right? That's one. But now that doesn't take away your emotions. It just takes away the physical piece.
Exactly.
Now, how do we transit someone from there and really kind of get them to this point to be like really aware?
Yeah. Well, really, the people that break out of addiction and self-destructive behaviors are ones that are treated on all levels and not just one. I mean, there's the physical level of, okay, let's deal with the biochemistry. Let's do what we can to get the brain right, repair the dopamine receptors and all that stuff. Okay, that's the physical. But then there's the emotional. which is dealing with what's driving the addiction, learning to manage that, learning to give it a voice, learning to express it in a healthy way, learning to love it. And then there's the psychological part, dealing with the distorted thoughts, the rationalizations, dealing with the impact on my mind of how I'm thinking from the addiction. And then the other level is the spiritual level. And that, you know, in some level, at its root, if you look at it spiritually, all addiction is a spirit. You know, even we call alcohol spirits. And so it takes one spirit to overcome another spirit. We need to somehow connect with, well, for me, it's connecting with God's spirit, but somehow connecting with the spirit that's more powerful than all the other spirits. Now, if you try to retreat, not addressing all those different levels, you're not going to have full success. Because the most common, without dealing with the spiritual, emotional, and psychological, the most common solution for an addiction is another addiction. So I quit drinking, but I'm smoking like a fish, and I quit smoking and I'm gambling, and I quit gambling and I'm hitting the strip clubs and I'm pornography, you know, whatever. It's like there's a switching. And what I'm doing is I'm doing the same process in my brain, but I'm just switching the substance or the behavior that's creating it. And if you don't deal with the other levels, you're not going to get freedom from that cycle.
So, doctor, do you think, I mean, I think if I'm reading, I mean, first of all, I love what you just said, because it clears it for everyone. But do you believe that in society, as we've been further away from faith and belief and religion and spirituality, you know, we are tending to be more on this spectrum of like problematic and emotional baggage and all stuff, because I think people who have a stronger belief, they tend to be stronger in areas and eventually win over those bad spirits.
I agree. I think there's truth to that, because I think the way we're fundamentally made, and so this is my bias, is that we're all made with a circular hole in the deepest part of ourselves that can only be filled with God's spirit. And when we can't find God's spirit to fill that circular hole, we go out and find something else to try to fill it. And drugs, alcohol, all addictive behaviors are like square pegs that kind of fit the hole, but it doesn't. It falls short. Because if I go to someone and say, look, you're using this drug, tell me what it's like when it's working. Well, I feel at peace. I feel at one with humanity. I'm relaxed. All my anxiety's gone. And I'm just okay. Then I talk to the monk who just had an encounter with God on the mountain. And I say, what was that like? Well, I feel at peace. And I feel at one with man, and I have no fear. They use the same exact words. And I say, well, what happened? Both are searching for the same thing. One actually has a lot better consequences, and the other one has a lot worse consequences. But in some level, I believe at its root, at its deepest level, all addiction is a spiritual search to fill the circular emptiness on the inside. And if we don't find a spiritual vision that fills that, we're going to fill it with something else. And that could be power, that could be finances, that could be all sorts of things. It could be drugs. And ultimately, we come to a day where we say, it's not enough. There's something missing. And I think on some level, you can't really have true mental health if you don't find true spiritual health.
Powerful, man. Thank you so much. I mean, I have to say it's a perfect alignment in terms of the descriptive here, because you're right. It's really, you fill in the gaps. That's all you're doing. And these things are, and people say that, like, you know, I feel good. I feel myself when I do these things. You know, I'm in a good place. I'm in cloud nine, whatever. You know, they can justify it. And typically, if you hear anyone, by the way, And this is not just, you know, for shows and stuff. I mean, everybody's got friends that have some sort of addiction, whether being just being in the watching movies 24/7 or food yeah. or anything. And that fills them up. They feel good about themselves while they're doing this. Some people go to the gym, you know, crazy. Like, I can't breathe without being in the gym, right? So whatever that is, the same answer keeps coming back is that it makes me feel good. It makes me feel good. But you're right. That is still not the full piece of who we are as humans and where we need to be. As long as we have those gaps, as you said, to find that final spiritual, you know, moment, you're going to keep these gaps, or you're going to keep, you know, trying to find something else to fill in the blank. Amazing, man. Thank you so much. Now, doctor, you know, I know we're coming to the hour here. So you have the book, that's The Roadmap to the Soul, right? That's actually available. Yeah. Now, but you also, you know, practice and work with people. Now, is this, you know, in just limited to your facility, or you do it, you know, online with everybody?
Yeah, we have a program called Transform You, which is an intensive online coaching program. 4-month program. It's a deep dive into all that we're talking about. And it's transformational. And we have individuals that come through. We have the cost also, if you come through as a couple, is the same as an individual. And my wife and I do 2 coaching calls a week, and there's a whole curriculum. And we just walk you through a process of transformation, managing all the things we were talking about. And everything can be found at our website, ihaveavoice.com. You can get a link to our book and our online program, Transform You. And even we have a YouTube channel that has hundreds of free videos. If that's something you would want to learn more about, some of the things we've talked about, and, you know, any way we can serve you. But those are really the main 3 routes.
Well, excellent. Well, that's plenty. I mean, if someone can get all of that, I mean, I think we can, you know, change a lot of lives. And again, folks, there you go. I mean, this is another resource that you can tap into in person or through the use of their tools, whether the book, the videos, and, you know, but again, best way, if you really think you need the help or you know someone who needs the help, this could be an ideal, you know, this could be a good gift for someone. I mean, if you know someone that is struggling, hey, maybe you get them into the program, providing they're willing to actually get into a program. Of course, that's always going to be a challenge. But certainly, here's another way to get someone. Imagine the impact that you will do if someone transforms themselves from, you know, just a missing, you know, spiritual environment to, you know, becoming full. It's a whole different thing. And, you know, it's satisfactory for you, be a good satisfaction, you know, whoever is doing that, as well as for those people. And they probably be thankful, and the next generation will be thankful. So, and by the way, doctor, you know, the work you do is definitely, you know, tremendous. And, you know, I guess, thank you for doing it, you know, and helping, you know, I guess the world one family, one couple at a time. I mean, one individual at a time, for that matter. And so we're about to the end of the show. Yeah, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I want to thank you for your work. I mean, I can see that you and your wife are passionate about bringing health, healing, wholeness to people, and really invested in that. And so I just bless your work and thank you for doing that also.
Well, thank you, and I'll take it. I was told a long time ago to accept compliment. So I'll take the compliment, you know, anytime. And you know what? It is fulfilling as a work, and I understand exactly what you do. And I do this for that same purpose, like, you know, with a mission, because there's not enough. I mean, listen, there's plenty, right? But it's not enough, and it's our job is just to spread it as much as far as we can get, and hopefully get people. Again, you know, there's, like you and I were talking before, there's talk shows, there's all kind of stuff that's out there. We just try to put in one network, one place where people can go in and not only just hear the information, but also connect with the source and the resource. And that's where we are. So thank you, Doc. And, you know, we didn't have your spouse with you here today, but hopefully we'll have another one. And if not, folks, you can still connect with both of them through their work and also through their videos. And I'll have all the links in the description of the show. Well, Doctor, the tradition is, before we close, you know, I just need some good advice of wisdom or pieces of wisdom that you can leave us with. What would those be?
I would say you're worth investing in yourself. There's no greater investment that you can make than in yourself, because every positive shift that you make has a rippling effect on everyone around you and just goes straight out. So take time, invest in yourself, and it'll have great impact on those you love.
Okay, I take that myself. Well, Dr. Dean Sanseri, thank you so much for being with us and for all the great time. I mean, 1 hour is worth billions, you know, gazillions right now. I mean, just listening to you, it's a pretty, you know, good privilege and honor for me, and definitely a lot of nuggets that we can all apply in life, and, you know, maybe do some checkpoints, you know, and see where we stand, and maybe this could be the trigger, like, hey, maybe I need some help, and then maybe take the necessary steps. So thank you so much, Doctor, for being with us. And we're at the end of the show, folks. So thank you so much for watching, listening, whatever you are. And I'm Kirk Nage. We'll be talking soon today on the show on the topic. Bye for now.